Gabriel program. You are cleared for departure. Have a good flight.
The Christopher Gabriel program begins now.
Your 50,000 watt sports leader in Fresno, the Central Valley, and for fans of the Netherlands now demanding a rematch with the U.S. soccer team in speed skating. 940 ESPN Fresno.com. Your 2 hour tour begins right now, 6 minutes, 2 seconds past the hour of 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. I'm the host of the program, Christopher Gabriel, delighted to be with you. Gorgeous afternoon here in the Central Valley. Hope it's beautiful wherever you happen to be listening to us today. Technical director, producer, Giants fan, hockey guy, Russ, keeping us going in the right direction. It's strange, we've been doing this for a couple of years now, Russ, and it's almost like somebody has rewired my headphones in here. It's a whole different... Everything sounds fine, but it sounds like I am in an attic. That is empty, and there's almost an echo. It's very strange. Are you getting that at all in your... Yeah, all right. Does it all sound normal coming across in your way? Well, then I guess we'll just keep going. I was going to say, let's just put music on for the next hour 52, but we'll just keep going. Runaway Ender in the program, 844-940-3776. You can follow me on Twitter, hope you do, at CG Program. Email CGP at 940ESPNFresno.com. Coming on the program today, in a couple of minutes, in about 12 minutes, we're going to welcome Mark Pazin from the California Office of Emergency Services. In light of the 6.4 and then the 5.4 and then the 7.1 earthquakes down in the Ridgecrest area and then thousands of aftershocks after that, just like whenever we have a wildfire, when we've had a dam breaking up in Northern California, whatever is going on that could affect, that does affect the lives of people in our state or could affect them depending upon a future event. We like to get ahead of the game a little bit, even if we're after the fact, because all of this happened when we weren't here, meaning the earthquakes down in Searles Valley. But we'll have Mark on. Mark is the chief of law enforcement for the California Office of Emergency Services, and he is dialed in to all the various plans, contingency plans, and so on that are in place. Listen, I'm not concerned that us here in Fresno are ever going to get some massive earthquake. Maybe I'm being ignorant. Just looking where fault lines go, what have you, doesn't seem that way. In the nearly 5 years I've been here, that's the first time in Fresno over this past couple of days that I felt anything here. But, I mean, listen, earthquakes can happen anywhere, as all of us know. Nevertheless, we all have friends. Most of us have family, different parts of the state, and it's never a bad thing when something like what's gone on the past couple of days, it's never a bad thing to get a reminder of what to do, how we should be prepared, and so on. Sometimes it takes the tornado touching down not far from you or going somewhere on vacation and getting caught in a hurricane. In both those cases, I've dealt with those too many times. Hurricane once, tornadoes more times than I can mention. Never a bad thing to go over that, so we'll have Mark Pazin join us in a couple of minutes. 3:35, our good friend Tony Diodato making his weekly visit to us on the program. We'll talk a little NBA, the battle for Los Angeles. We'll continue that at 4:05, talking with Mr. Laker himself, Alan Sliwa, host of Lakers Talk on ESPN Los Angeles, Mondays, 7 to 9 p.m. Suffice to say, Alan has been peaks and valleys emotionally as it applies to the Lakers and where was Kawhi going, and we'll get into all of that. I mean, We left, you know, of course, Thursday we were off. Friday we weren't in as well. And it seems like we leave for a couple of days and everything just, you know, goes crazy, just goes nuts. What a free agency period this has been. So we'll talk with Alan about that. And then final half hour, 4:35, our elite soccer mind, Joel Listman. He called it, I think most people called it, not all, but most people called it that the U.S. would win the World Cup. They did win, beating the Netherlands yesterday 2-0, 2-0. It was a great performance. My favorite player on that team is Rose Lavelle. I just love the way she plays. I love her energy. She always seems to be in the right place at the right time. She had a few goals. I think she had three during this World Cup. I know that Megan Rapinoe gets the lion's share of attention for a number of different reasons. So does Alex Morgan and two or three others on the team. But I really enjoy watching Rose Lavelle play. And we're going to try to get Rose or somebody on in the next couple of weeks. I'm sure they're going to be very busy with various parades and celebrations in their towns and getting back to the business of what they do every day. Some of them, most of them, playing on national women's soccer league teams. Maybe some going over to play in Europe. But Joel will fill us in on all that. And then at 5 o'clock or thereabouts, give or take a couple of seconds either side of the top of the hour, we will take you to Cleveland for national coverage of tonight's Home Run Derby contest. And of course, the winner is going to be getting $1 million. That's been the big selling point of the Home Run Derby contest this year. And I've not really understood why that is, because it's not going to affect any of us. Hey, oh, isn't that great? He won $1 million. Is it going to change your life? You know, I mean, watching the Home Run Derby, because you really want to watch these guys park shots at Cleveland Stadium. It used to be Jacobs Field. Now is it Progressive Field still? Do we think that's what it is? Yeah. So watching guys hit shots, that's cool. I'm kind of over the Home Run Derby, but that'll be on at 5, and then tomorrow we have a one-hour show because we will take you back to Cleveland this time for the main event, the All-Star Game. That's all the baseball All-Star Game, obviously always fun to watch. Also, my thanks to all of you who dropped me a note on email or sent me a private message, or those of you who have my cell phone sending me a text message. And especially my thanks to Julia Lopez. I had a chance to, for the first time, to appear on Bulldog Insider. And that was at 6 p.m. last night on KC24. The link is out there if you want to watch, at least for the second back, the B block, little TV jargon there, the B block, where I talk about with Julia about Fresno State. We talked about what I believe is ridiculous, the 13.5-point line that has been set, or wherever it's at right now. It's in that general area by Vegas. We talked about that. We talked about the defense. We talked about Jorge Reyna. And things that I'm looking forward to in the season. It's all out there, and it was just great fun doing that with Julia last night. And as I said to her when she asked on air, I'd be happy to come back anytime. It's always a treat to have her in my house, so to speak. So it was fun to visit her among her own setting there. That was a good time. Well, my goodness, a lot has happened since the last time we saw you. How many of you felt the earthquakes? How many of you thought that Kawhi Leonard was not only going to go to the Clippers, but was going to manage to get Paul George to go there as well? I mean, the dust has largely settled. For months, back in the regular season of the NBA, I was of the opinion, I didn't really even have an opinion, I shouldn't even say that. I just kind of went along with the narrative, which was, well, if Kawhi is interested in Los Angeles, he's going to the Clippers. But over time, listen, you heard me on this show and you heard me with Tony. I said, nope, let's rule them out. He's not going to the Clippers. For as many times you get things right, boy, as many times or more, I get them wrong. And I absolutely had ruled out the Los Angeles Clippers for Kawhi. And then, you know, we saw the plane landing, the private jet in Toronto, the black Suburbans, the motorcade, and Tony and I were talking, and the national guys were talking. Everybody was breaking down what they believed he was signing or about to sign whether it was in Toronto, whether it was going to be in San Diego at his home down there, whether it was going to be in Las Vegas catching a little summer league action, all of us thought, I guess he's going to go back. Going to do a one plus one or a two plus one, whatever the case may be, he's going to be a Toronto Raptor, and Danny Green will stay there, and it's going to be a team that will again be the favorite to win the NBA title next year. That did not happen. Suddenly we hear he's going to the Clippers, and oh, by the way, Paul George, who spurned LeBron James last year, didn't even give the Lakers a meeting because he loves Oklahoma City. He loves playing with Russell Westbrook. He's there, man. He's good to go. He is Oklahoma City proud. I'm going to tattoo OKC on my arm. Less than a year later, he's gone. And it's funny to hear a lot of these NBA players on various national shows, radio and TV, saying different versions of, and maybe they're trying to stay tight with either Russell Westbrook or LeBron James. But have you noticed the theme here? All these guys, one after another, coming out saying, you know, hey, listen, this is not a shot against Russell Westbrook. Really? You really don't think so? Kevin Durant was there. James Harden was there. Paul George was there. One, two, three, you're out. They're gone. Russell's still there. He's not going to be there for long, I don't think. And then you have the other man in the equation. I wouldn't say that there have been players that have just not wanted to play with LeBron. I mean, look, Anthony Davis went there. That's right. But who didn't go there? Klay Thompson didn't take any meetings with them. Kevin Durant said, nah, not interested. You saw what Paul George did last year. No, not interested. Yeah, I love Southern California. Really wanted to get home, but nah, I don't want to be part of that. How many players have actually come out and say they didn't want to play with LeBron, or they talk about others? And so there's this almost circling the wagons mentality in play here. So hearing these former NBA players come out, you know, en masse and say, or en masse, whichever you prefer, and say that this is by no means any kind of reflection on Russell Westbrook or LeBron James for guys that have left Russell Westbrook or guys that didn't want to go to LeBron James, that's nonsense. That's pure nonsense. It may not be the sole reason, but it certainly is part of the reason in both cases. And now, I guess to a lesser degree, we're on Russell Westbrook watch. And one of the teams that I hear getting thrown around a little bit is the Miami Heat. Oh, that I want to see that. I want to see Russell Westbrook and Jimmy Butler on the same team. That because Jimmy Butler doesn't seem to get along with anybody. Oh, you know, I know a lot of teammates dig him, but he's had his issues. You very well documented, not just by me. Had his issues in Chicago. Had his issues in Minneapolis. Had his issues in Philadelphia. Now he's on Miami, and he went to a team that's really not, they're not going to do anything. He's not winning any championship in Miami. I don't care if Russell Westbrook goes there or not. No more championships are coming to Miami anytime soon unless something else is going to happen and LeBron's going back down there. Or Kevin Durant, you know what I'm saying? And now we have these pairings around the league. We have Irving and Durant. We have AD and LeBron. We have Leonard and George. And then pick a tandem on the Warriors. Curry and Clay. Curry and Draymond. Clay and Draymond. You have Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons of the Sixers. You have all these neat little combos. And then you have a couple of other teams that I really like that have gotten better by who they've kept and who they've added. Utah and Portland immediately come to mind. Milwaukee Bucks, it's Giannis. I mean, I don't know. They didn't really add anything, and if anything, the Bucks lost a piece. So we'll get into all that in a little bit with Tony Diodato, bottom of the hour. Coming up, we are going to switch gears here for a moment, get serious in terms of things that are life and death and affect us here in California, because we have a big reach on 940 ESPN, and so we want to bring on Mark Pazin from the California Office of Emergency Services and just find out about earthquake preparedness, as well as statewide plans in place for any kind of worst-case scenario. Glad you're joining us. This is the CGP.
more of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Sometimes, and it seems almost strange to say this, but it's true, when we talk about earthquakes, and not the ones that we see that happen a half a world away, when you hear of entire towns getting obliterated and you see these horrific videos, here, when you hear of one in an area that maybe not a lot of people are familiar with, like Ridgecrest, and the videos, we watch water splashing in pools, we watch stadium scoreboards in Las Vegas moving, we see the center field camera at Dodger Stadium bouncing up and down, we have a bit of a detached attitude towards them, almost a bit of whimsy, because, well, we're not right there. We're not where this 7.1 earthquake is happening. But when you start to do a little digging, you discover that, yeah, there really are people that live down there. And I saw a picture of a city, of a meeting down in what I guess was City Hall or the mayor's offices or a town hall meeting, and it was overflowing and packed, and you had people learning about what to do relative to mental health concerns, to building inspections, to access for basic services. And that brings it home that this is a real event, or this has been real events that are affecting real people. And when that happens, we realize in California it can be anyone, anywhere. And that's why there is nobody that I would rather have on this program than a guy who has come on many, many times, never just to talk baseball or something. He is the chief of law enforcement for the California Office of Emergency Services, Mark Pazin. Mark, how are you, my friend?
Good. How you been? How's everything?
Things are good. I guess where I want to start is Ridgecrest. Did I set that up in a fair way?
Well, it could have been much fairer. You can call when there's no emergency. That's okay, too.
Well, you know, we tend to forget that, you know, we hear about Ridgecrest and Searles, or however you pronounce it, Valley. You know, I wasn't even aware that there were anybody living in the area because nobody was talking about those people. But then you realize, Mark, there are people and families and what have you that do live there.
Well, there's 40 million people in the state of California, just about every nook and cranny. The small township of Trona, which borders San Bernardino County, was also impacted as it hits Inyo and Kern County and, like I mentioned, San Bernardino. There are a lot of persons affected and still are as we speak.
So What is the best way to proceed here? You know, we talk about having, you know, when I was in the Midwest, that's where I'm from, as you know, we mm-hmm. always had preparation packs at home for tornadoes, for driving in winter conditions. You and I on this program have talked about during the winter when you're going to be driving through the grapevine, what to have in your car. Down in the southeast, people understand about having hurricane preparedness packs. What are the kinds of things, Mark, that you suggest that Cal OES suggests people should have ready, irrespective of where they live in the state, when it comes to earthquake preparedness?
Well, first off, you can go to our website at Cal, this is all one word, caloes.ca.gov. It'll give you whatever you need to know. Director Ghilarducci is very pointed in ensuring that website is fresh and up to speed. We were with Governor Newsom all day Saturday. We all started and revved up the State Operations Center. So to your point, it's just like any common sense type of packaging, food, water, snacks, flashlight, battery-operated radio, the items that you normally would never even think about as you went to your local big box store or went shopping. These are the things here in California now that it's got everybody's attention. 7.1 earthquake will grab some scrutiny. You have to start thinking about that, and I always refer everyone to our website.
We're visiting with Chief Mark Pazin, Law Enforcement Division, Cal OES. That's the Office of Emergency Services. They do phenomenal work in this state, north to south, east to west, whenever there is anything that demands attention and there are life and death situations. We always bring Mark on for things like that. Mark, can you, and I know this might be a very broad question, so answer it any way you like. How difficult is it to have set up statewide contingency plans or emergency plans for worst-case scenarios when it comes to earthquakes in terms of command and control, various agencies from fire, Red Cross, police, and so on throughout the state?
Unfortunately, we're getting a little too good at it. The State Operations Center was up and running immediately. The 4th of July that evening, we were already on conference calls. That next day, when the 7.1 hit, we were all prepared, and we're standing tall here at the Operations Center on that Saturday. You know, under the Emergency Management Services Act, Director Ghilarducci has a broad authority as given to him by the governor. Then it was Brown, now it's Governor Newsom. So we're able to immediately pull together every state agency, and this is what our priorities are. You know, obviously it's protection of life, property, and the environment. You know, our second part is to ensure that we support shelter operations, and especially for those persons with special needs, access and functional needs. You know, the next one, and that's what we're going through today, is the transition from the initial response to ensure that there were no, thank goodness there were no fatalities, but we already had urban search and rescue on the ground that following morning from my counterpart, Brian Marshall, who some persons may be familiar with. He used to be the Kern County Fire Chief. Now he's my counterpart here at Fire and Rescue. So as we start all that, now we gently go into the recovery stage and we start to establish local assistance centers.
So when you and I talk about, and we have talked about flash flooding, we've talked about the dam, and was it Oroville?
Yes.
The dam breaking. When we talk about wildfires raging out of control, and then, of course, we have earthquakes, you have so many, as you just articulated, so many plans in place and all the communication, and as you said, unfortunately, you're getting too good at it. What is a worst-case scenario for you, or is the worst-case scenario something that you just, you know, you won't know until it happens?
You know, great question, and that's what we do here at Cal OES, both on the law side, the fire side, and the recovery side, is preparing and protecting California. That is our motto. And so we hold that very close to us when these incidents occur, whether it was numerous fires last year about this time. Now we faced an earthquake. There was like 2,400 some odd aftershocks that I have here in front of me from our report from this morning. It just goes on and on. So what we do is try to lean forward, as Director Ghilarducci likes to call it. Governor Newsom has been very engaged with this. He was here again, like I mentioned, all day Saturday. They flew down to Ridgecrest. So all I can tell you is that we're on it. We're prepared. We have all the state agencies here at the Unified Command Group. We've been holding morning conference calls or in person and evening conference calls just to get situational awareness on what has happened, what do we believe will happen, and how can we best assist the citizenry of that particular affected area.
Last thing for you, and I'll relate it again back to comfort food, if I can use that term, in terms of where I grew up. The thing about tornadoes, you didn't know where they were going to pop up, but you understood when there were conditions in place for tornadic activity. Meteorologists have gotten extremely good at letting us know that. In the case of hurricanes, we see them. We know they're coming. We know their direction. We know they can go a little bit east or a little bit northeast or a little bit northwest, you know, on all the computer mapping, but we know they're coming. We don't really know with earthquakes, but the USGS has been talking about lowering the threshold a little bit for letting, you know, Californians know that there might be something going on. Do you have, does your agency, Mark, have any communication with people like the USGS, with a Dr. Lucy Jones, people like them, in terms of what they're thinking and then how it impacts what you're doing?
They are sitting in our state operations center. They are giving us the best probabilities to their ability about the aftershocks, what to expect. I mean, they were so far down into the weeds about the percentages. I think it was 3% to have a 7.0 or larger given the system that they were looking at. So the eruptions and such. So all I can tell you, and you and the listeners that were on it, we have everybody here from the National Guard, Highway Patrol. I tell you who did a phenomenal job was Chief McLaughlin there at Ridgecrest and Sheriff Donnie Youngblood. I was in communication with them just to ensure that people were not victimized again via criminal activity because, you know, persons had to leave their house. We had two situations there in Ridgecrest. Somebody stole some from a gas station, and there might have been an attempted burglary. But we got those law enforcement assets there immediately, compliments of Sheriff Youngblood and that operational area.
Well, folks, you've heard Mark Payson on with me before. I don't say it lightly when I say there's nobody that I would rather talk to more when it comes to this kind of topical area than you, because you always give us a great overview and you give us nothing but straight talk. I'm going to put the link out for your site as well, again, just so that everybody has it in front of them. And I'm glad we're talking about something that there was no fatalities. And it's very comforting to know that the folks at USGS and all of them are right there, and you guys are in such great communication. Folks, he's Mark Payson. Mark, a great pleasure as always, my friend.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Absolutely. You too. Invaluable stuff, and I'm going to put that link out right now. We will get back to the toy department and talk about the Lakers and about the Clippers and the free agency and all of that good stuff with our good friend Tony Diodato. This is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Christopher Gabriel returns.
Well, it's always interesting making a transition, talking about earthquakes and statewide emergency plans set up for any kind of worst-case scenario, to bring in Tony Diodato and talk about the ultimate of the toy department. We saw all of it and more play out. Of course, once we say goodbye for the holidays, then it all just breaks loose. Tony and I both very confidently on Friday said, nope, Kawhi's not going to the Clippers, and he went to the Clippers. Tony Diodato joining me right now. Tony, how shocked were you, maybe not so much about Kawhi, but the Kawhi and Paul George?
Well, yeah, that was the combination. And CG, after we wrapped up at 4 o'clock on Friday, I took the flight to Las Vegas to call what was supposed to be four quarters of Zion Williamson.
Yes.
And for two reasons. One, the earthquake, or 1A, the earthquake, and one, as far as why he wasn't playing, the injury. And now, of course, he's out for all the summer league, which isn't that big a deal. But, yes, to answer your question, I am stunned by this because of what you're talking about. Look, when you and I, the quick summary of Friday, as we were talking, right at the end of the conversation, I had mentioned to you that I thought that the dilemma that Kawhi was facing is that each of the three teams, franchises, carried a certain positive and a certain negative. He wanted stability. He wanted star power around him that gave him a chance to win again, but he also didn't want to be overwhelmed by that star power. I mean, he wanted to set the pace, but he also wanted to be close to home. And so what we had, as we talked, CG, you had the stability and the proper roster in Toronto, but what you didn't have is the one thing. You know, you can choose your friends but not your relatives, right?
Right.
You can't reconcile being in Toronto, and that's what Nick Nurse said. I don't blame him. Want to go home. L.A., you had the locale. There's no doubt about it. Now you had the stability, as we talked, with the Clippers, but the star power with the Lakers, so he couldn't. It was a little column A, column B, column C. He needed to try to get a confluence somewhere. And I'm with you. I never dreamt given that criteria, that the one thing that would happen would be the mountain would come to Muhammad, that the Clippers would do the audacious thing and go mortgage part of their future. Just talked to Dave Severns in their front office about this a few minutes ago on air. They basically said, for all intents and purposes, scared money doesn't make money, right?
That's it.
They threw four draft choices. They threw the kitchen sink. It was a show with everything in Yul Brynner. They threw it all out there, and I had mentioned to you it would take the offer he couldn't refuse. Evidently, that was it. That's why I'm stunned, because I never saw it coming. And OKC now is piece by piece just dismantled their team right before our eyes in the space of about 72 hours.
No question. And Tony, I want to throw a couple of things at you, because I have Alan Sliwa, who is, of course, our good friend of the program. He's the host of Lakers Talk on ESPN right. Los Angeles. We're going to focus more on the Lakers. Let's talk a little bit about the Clippers for a second. And tell me if you think I'm overstating any of this. I said that I really believe, and I'm not equating Kawhi and Paul George to the equal of Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, but I do think they are the best 1-2 star defensive punch in terms of that kind of combo that we've seen in quite a while. That's one I want you to jump on. The other, if you're a Clippers fan, you have got to be feeling like, finally, something good has happened with this franchise. Because, I mean, the Lakers have always, they always had the form. The Clippers were in the disaster that was known as the Los Angeles Memorial Sports Arena. Then they both go into the Staples Center, it wasn't even the little brother. They were like the ugly seventh cousin from Bolivia, that with all due respect to Bolivians, that nobody wanted in the building. You know, you had the majestic purple and gold and the 16 banners, and then the very, very pedestrian red and blue. And, well, you got Billy Crystal at half court. So much has changed now, Tony.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, look, you're right. You're right in particular about the poor stepchild approach. They are three in that building. That's the reason they play
yes.
in the afternoon. Because the Kings have a game at night. It's why Steve Ballmer wants to build the new arena by 2024 and get out of that situation.
Yep.
But we have talked so often, CG, you talk about a star-crossed franchise. Buffalo Braves, they were pretty good. You know, Macca do, Macca don't, Macca can't, Macca won't. Bob McAdoo was more mm-hmm. concerned, until he got to the Lakers, when he was the go-to guy, more concerned about scoring than winning titles. He had Randy Smith. They had a good team, but they were in Buffalo, and it didn't work. They went to San Diego, where they had a legitimate shot, except Bill Walton could not get healthy again. And Bill Walton will tell you that's the reason they failed in San Diego. People say, well, they don't go to indoor sports in San Diego. Bill said they didn't go because I got hurt, and as a native son, I wasn't good enough to carry. Kind of what happened with Maravich, right?
Yeah.
With the New Orleans
yeah.
Jazz, although Pete wasn't from there. He was close enough because of going to LSU. But when they got to L.A., you're right, they were a running joke. Donald Sterling was head-to-head with Ted Stepien, the worst owner in the history
Terrible.
Of professional sport, and maybe the worst human being
mm-hmm.
ever owning a team. Everything went wrong. If they went on a plane flight, they said that they ended up, CG, with people laughing at them. If they were announced in the old days of the commercial flight, right, the L.A. Clippers were with us, people would laugh. They would laugh at them. And now you look up, and after all the close calls, I mean, look what happened in that Portland series, right? When Chris, it's one thing to get your two stars hurt, as the Warriors found out, but how about getting your two stars hurt in the same quarter, CG?
Right.
You
right.
have to think that there's something desperately going mm-hmm. wrong in the universe that plays against you. Now you look up, and the Lakers are going to be really, really good. The Clippers feel like they're going to be better, and they feel like finally they're going to get some respect. Though the one thing Dave mentioned to me last hour, still a long way to go, and I would agree with him completely. There's still a long way to go, but it's great to see him like this, that's for sure.
I agree, and I put out on Twitter over the weekend, how long before the NBA announces that your featured Christmas Day game will be Clippers-Lakers? You know that's coming. That's just the way it is. All right, so let me throw a couple of combo platters at you, and this comes with the preface, Tony, that everybody's healthy. Which combo platter do you like better? Irving and Durant, AD and LeBron, Kawhi and Paul George, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson?
Well, right now, and what you brought up before, I think, to answer that part of that question, when fully healthy
yes.
in their respective primes, the best combination, LeBron and AD. The problem is LeBron is beyond his prime. He's still a great, great player, but and there's still tread left on the tires. But LeBron is not the same LeBron even as recently as the block on Iguodala in the 2016 finals. He's not the same guy. Been this guy, as you know, who started right out of high school, and it just takes its toll. Injury for the first time has started to bother him. So of that grouping, I would have to say if you want the combination of both sides of the court, because Durant, we said at full health, Durant may never be back at full health. Klay Thompson will be at some point, but he also is a running mate of another guard. So when I look at this, the perfect combo as far as lockdown, Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. They are in their athletic prime. They are both lockdown defenders. They've got Patrick Beverley around them. That team is going to be brutally difficult to score again come playoff time.
By the way, I've heard your phone ringing. I know that's Daryl Howerton calling, wanting to talk about the Spurs. He wants to jump aboard and just say, wait a minute, let's not forget about talking about the Spurs. Just a second.
He'll get his chance later in the week.
Of course he will.
But that's a great duo, though. And you know what?
Yeah.
What I love about it, not just that it's the Clippers, but Kawhi restored my sense of Kawhi as a person. And CG, this is my question to you, and I have been grappling with this since the news came out. Like I said, in Vegas, people were running, understandably so, because the Jumbotron was swaying.
Yes,
about three hours later, they were staggering around Vegas for the first time, not because of the nightlife, but because of what they were hearing. But I look at this thing right now, and I would like to believe that it was going to be, if not the Clippers, Toronto. And that's the due credit that I'm giving Kawhi. But is there part of you that says, since the Clippers did this out of response to saying we don't want the Lakers to be that dynastic team right under our nose in the same building, where was Kawhi going if the Clippers did not get, let's say for the sake of argument, Sam Presti, GM and OKC said, no, we're not parting with Paul George, and there was no other superstar remaining. What was Kawhi going to do? Was he going to go across the hall to the Lakers, or was he going to go back to Toronto?
I'm with you. I really believe that what we've seen Kawhi do and what has come out from very reliable sources, people like Adrian Wojnarowski and Ramona Shelburne.
That's probably who it was on the phone, by the way. Yeah, Woj said, you wanted to know something about Tark? I finally have 2 minutes. Let's go.
See, that's it. Here's your shot, Tony.
That's right, exactly.
I really believe that we would have seen him in the most limited contract possible going back to Toronto. I think Danny Green would have stayed there. I mean, there's a lot of what-ifs and ifs in play here, but I really believe that one begets the other. I don't think that I truly don't believe that it's in his character makeup. And granted, Tony, we only see what he wants to show us. We have heard from people who know him saying that he is just this funny, engaging guy. So clearly, to the rest of the world, he only wants to show that little bit. And that's
right.
Fine. He has a right to do that. But I do believe at his core, he is a guy that takes care of business his own way. He's not swayed by getting recruited by a LeBron, because he knows, LeBron, you're not that far ahead of me in championships. You are far ahead of me in age, and I'm as good a player as you are. I've got the ability to do some stuff here, and the bird in hand and so on. I really believe Toronto was a great fallback for him, and I do believe that Danny Green would have stayed, and it would have been a great situation for him. So I don't think he would have gone to the Lakers. I just don't think that's his character makeup, Tony.
Yeah, I have to agree with you, CG, and as you and I talked, it wasn't a case of multiple-year, monster 4-year, 5-year deals of the three places. He had the one kind of have the difference where he could have gone back to Toronto on the one and the option year, which would have given him flexibility, particularly heading to the Supermax. Though I will tell you, the Clippers were very much afraid of that super team across the hall. But I also think, and it's something you just brought up, if you're Kawhi, you're saying, you know what, I want competitive balance myself, but I want the best for me. But if you're the Clipper front office, you may be saying, if the best for him happened to be in Toronto, we were still going to be playing second fiddle to the Lakers, even with just LeBron and AD. And I think that might be something that's been lost with the background of, oh, we don't want the three of them there. And I know they didn't. But, CG, could you make the argument if they didn't make the bold move and Kawhi stays in Toronto that even the duo of LeBron and AD would have been enough to shove the Clippers right off the cliff again as far as media coverage and being the less than darlings of the area?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it, because it doesn't take much to use New York City vernacular. It doesn't take much to move the Clippers to page six. It just doesn't. And that's where they've lived, if they've lived anywhere, and they weren't even above the fold forever. So I think that the Lakers, with LeBron, and I have said before, we have a regular tweeter and a listener to the program. We love him, Seawalk. I said to him earlier that he should be working for Lakers publicity, because the Lakers could start 0-40 and he'll say, it's good. Everything's going to be fine here. But the fact of the matter is, I think LeBron, he's a little older. The tread is worn down a little bit, but I think that he has probably, knowing LeBron like we do, he's probably had his fill of everybody telling him that, or not using him in the phrasing of being one of the greatest or the greatest player in the world. He's going to come back healthy. He's going to come back better rested than he's ever been, which I think will counter his age a little bit. I think if he's going to have a monster year, and if the Lakers are going to win a title with him, I really believe this is the year. When you look at him and AD, and you have some serviceable parts, I don't necessarily think that Danny Green, Rajon Rondo, JaVale McGee, these guys are names because they've done some things in the playoffs. Well, not so, Rajon Rondo before, but this is still a little bit, the team is still made up a little bit of blue light special guys. We're not talking about a team of six frontliners. We're talking about a team that's got a couple of main guys and then a couple of really good serviceable parts that can really do some nice damage.
Well, look, Kuzma's an outstanding player.
Kuzma's terrific,
Avery Bradley is going to sign a two-year deal there. The Warriors wanted Bradley, and I'm not saying this is a little tit-for-tat, because the Lakers wanted D'Angelo Russell back, and they thought they were going to get him, and their reasoning was pretty sound, which was if they weren't going to get Kawhi, they could get D'Angelo back because they had the salary room and the cap, and then the Warriors turned around and made the deal. The Lakers are still going to be outstanding.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you my only worry. I was mentioning this to Severance and Paul last hour. This is the greatest time to be an NBA fan if you're sitting in this particular geographic area, because DirecTV gives us all four of the California teams without paying extra for them. Nobody else gets that. The Warriors and the Kings come here. We get the Lakers and the Clippers as well. My one worry, CG, you can say there are maybe 10 teams instead of the Warriors to go ahead and ruin everybody's party, right, that could win the thing in the two conferences combined. But what you just brought up, I'm worried that the already too long 82-game season is going to be met with, you know what? Look at what happened in the finals. You played six games. The home team won only one. Only one of the six. Seeding doesn't matter. Therefore, health does. Load management does. And we're going to have a regular season where all the superstars and the teams are saving it so much that we're all going to be saying at the start of November, when in the world will the middle of April get here? That's going to be unfortunate if everybody is just playing for April and afraid to play their best ball and their best players too many minutes. That's going to take the fun out of the league. When the Warriors won the first 24 in a row, coming off the bend of the 15th title, that was a lot of fun. Watching the best teams take it easy for 6 months is not going to be a lot of fun if that happens come October.
I'll just say this. I think we can all agree, and we'll end on this note, that load management trumps exit velocity and launch angle.
I think you're absolutely right about that. Completely right, and we will see. I can't wait for this year. The Warriors have done some really good things. The four teams in California are going to be really good, but I feel sorry for the teams trying to make the playoffs, trying to rebuild in the West. man, that's a tough deal.
Oh, absolutely right. Folks, he is Tony Diodato. You can hear him every day, 2 to 3, and then on Fridays, 2 to 4. Comes on right before me, Monday through Thursday. And then he joins me at 3:35 on this show on Mondays. A lot of times, I hope you're writing him down. And then on Wednesdays, I join him at 2:35.
I'm writing him down.
Yeah, and then sure. Friday, it's 3 to 4. And then sometimes we just do special Sunday podcasts just for the heck of it. Tony, always a great pleasure, my friend.
Save the UCG. I'm picking you up. We're heading back to Vegas tonight. I want you on the plane. You're going to get on that plane. You're getting on that plane. All right.
I am ready.
To it.
I'm ready.
That would be a great trip. I don't know if we'd survive it. The city might not survive it, but it would be a lot of fun trying. That's for sure.
Thank you, sir. That's it. Gosh. Oh, my gosh. One last minute left. This is a CGP. Just a couple of seconds to close out hour number one. Hour number two is the final hour today. Stay with me. It's a little bit of math, but we have the Home Run Derby coming on right here on 940 ESPN at 5 p.m., well, give or take a half a minute or so. Coming up, we're going to talk more on the Lakers side of this now with our good friend from Lakers Talk, host of Lakers Talk on ESPN Los Angeles, Alice Lee. Stay with us.
From the studios of 940 ESPN in Fresno, California, this is the Christopher Gabriel Program.
Hour number two of your two-hour Monday program, Home Run Derby, live from Cleveland, coming up in about 54 minutes. But we begin right now, 5 minutes, 39 seconds past the hour of 4 p.m. Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Glad to have you aboard. Beautiful day here in the Central Valley. I am assuming it is just as beautiful down in Los Angeles where we find this gentleman. So many things on my mind to talk with Alan Sliwa about. He is the host of Lakers Talk Mondays, 7 to 9 p.m. ESPN Los Angeles. He joins me right now. First question for you, did you feel the 7.1?
You know, I was actually, it's kind of ironic. I went to San Diego for 2 days, and the 2 days I was there, there were two earthquakes in Los Angeles,
wow.
So I didn't feel anything. Felt nothing the whole time.
Isn't it funny how that works? Because a lot of times, you know, the 6.4 here, I didn't feel. A lot of people did. The 7.1, I absolutely felt, as did most of the people that I've talked to. In my, you want to call it my circle, but there are people here in our broadcast center who said didn't feel it at all, just didn't really pay it much mind. But you've certainly been through earthquakes down there, have you not?
Yeah. I mean, nothing, you know, major, but anytime the floor under you is shaking,
yeah.
I guess that's a little bit concerning. But I didn't feel anything. Literally, both those earthquakes, I was down in San Diego.
Well, that's probably nothing wrong with that. By the way, email from Derek. The CGP is your daily home run derby. I'll take that. I'll definitely take that. So I guess, you know, we were off Thursday and Friday. And, of course, the days that were off because of a holiday or what have you, it just everything breaks loose. I don't even know where to start. How about this? Did you foresee Kawhi to the Clippers, or did you foresee Paul George and Kawhi to the Clippers?
You know, Clippers were always, once free agency started, there picked up a lot of steam and a lot of momentum that the Lakers had a legitimate chance. And then Kawhi Leonard flew back to Toronto, and then that kind of picked up steam. Jalen Rose at one point said 99% chance that he'll re-sign with the Raptors and maybe do like a two-year deal. So I think everybody just assumed it was between the Lakers and it was between the Lakers and the Raptors. So what went down on Friday night was not only a shock that he obviously chose the Clippers, Kawhi Leonard chose the Clippers, but just the way the Clippers, you know, positioned themselves to go out and get Paul George to make sure Kawhi Leonard came. I just assumed that when Jimmy Butler went to Miami or Kemba Walker went to Boston or Kevin Durant decided to go to Brooklyn, there wasn't a second star to pair Kawhi Leonard with. So I did think the Clippers were definitely an uphill battle. But I guess if Jerry West has anything to do with your franchise, you have a shot. And most definitely he made it happen, as did Steve Ballmer and Lawrence Frank and obviously Doc Rivers as well.
Well, the last half hour I was talking with a one of our hosts here on 940, Tony Diodato, and we focused most of our discussion on the Clippers. So obviously with you, I want to focus most of our discussion with your team, with the Lakers. I will propose this to you, and I know that I'm not the only person who said it, but I thought at the moment I heard it, I really feel like one of the most interesting choices or roster additions for the Lakers is Boogie Cousins, because if he comes back healthy, you know, it's very easy to think about Boogie this past season where he was out up through the first week of January, so I don't think he came back until, you know, sometime after the turn of the year. I'm just wondering, it's been so much has happened since then. And when he was playing well, he was doing tremendous things on the court for this team, for this Warriors team. I mean, he's a guy who can score. He's a guy who can, if he can handle the ball a little bit, he's a wonderful passer. He's a big body on the low blocks, and he's the kind of guy, I mean, he and Anthony Davis obviously know each other very well. They work very well together. I think this is a great addition that the Lakers have brought aboard.
So I want to look at DeMarcus. I'm going to look at it from this angle. First thing I'll say is, and I said this before the Lakers signed him, you know, when free agency started and Adrian Wojnarowski had, I think, come on SportsCenter or something like that and just said there's no market for DeMarcus Cousins. And a lot of that money was being dried up anyways. It had already gone to a lot of these, you know, obviously other free agents. I feel bad for DeMarcus. So as much as I want to see the Lakers succeed, I'm a Lakers fan. I really just want to see DeMarcus Cousins have a good season so he can get a contract that is more sustainable than 1 year. You know, these last 2 years, that's pretty much what he's got is the league minimum. And I feel, you know, for the Lakers, from their standpoint, it's a very low risk. And if they're smart about this, which I think they will be, there is absolutely no rush of when DeMarcus Cousins plays and how many games that he does play for the Lakers. What I'm hoping for is they can just try and get him healthy. And if they can, you know, your goal is by the time January rolls, if DeMarcus Cousins is playing good basketball and he feels healthy and he feels good, you just want to get, you know, obviously a good playoff run to have him a part of it. But I do think it was a signing that probably that DeMarcus Cousins wanted as well. This will be a good opportunity for him to continue to kind of keep himself in the spotlight so that he can potentially get paid down the road.
Yeah, I guess I see it the way you see it, but I do see it a little differently because I heard those reports, and we talked about those reports on here, Alan, that there was no market for him, and then, of course, then he changed agents. And a lot of times players in all sports, they have a price, they have an idea of what their worth is, and the rest of the league, whichever league we're talking about, maybe sees it differently, and that's why offers didn't come in. But, you know, I'm not saying that you're doing this, but I can't go down the road that somehow DeMarcus Cousins is, you know, is living on the street. He's living in a tent, and he's having a rough – I mean, he's in the NBA. He's making – he's still going to make some great money. He's playing on the Los Angeles Lakers with LeBron James, Anthony Davis, Kyle Kuzma, throw in a couple of others like Rajon Rondo, JaVale McGee, Quinn Cook, not necessarily headliners, but he's on a good team. He's going to be playing in front of sold-out arenas every single night of the year this coming season. I mean, things could be worse for him.
Could be worse, 100% could be, but I'm going to look at it from this standpoint. You know, we're only a year and a half removed from maybe 2 years now, whatever it was, when he tore his ACL when he was with the Pelicans. So when I say I feel bad for him is he thought at one point he'd be getting a max contract in the NBA at this stage of his career. He's just 28. He'll be 29 in August, so he's walking into his prime right now. That could very well not happen. So when I say I feel bad, what I'm referring to is he's not going to get that maybe $100 million contract or that $140 million contract like you're seeing some of these other players, right? Kemba Walker, Kawhi Leonard, Jimmy Butler. So that part of it he's going to probably miss out on because of these injuries, because we know when he was healthy and he was a DeMarcus Cousins that you and I remember, he was an MVP candidate, and he was certainly you know, good enough to be one of the league's elite. He's falling further and further away from that.
Alan Sliwa is my guest, a regular visitor to our program. He is the host of Lakers Talk. If you haven't checked it out, you should. It's wonderful. 7 to 9 Mondays on ESPN Los Angeles. I also like the Danny Green pickup. I thought that, you know, I saw him during the year, as we all did, and he never really jumped out at me. But what jumped out at me about Danny Green is when he got on the biggest stage, you know, with the biggest audience, he performed big. And I think that that experience is going to serve him well now that he is going and playing with a couple of guys named LeBron and AD and playing in the bright lights of Los Angeles, which is a much bigger, brighter stage than Toronto. I think he was also a terrific pickup by the Lakers.
Yeah, he was. I think he was a player when free agency started, and the Lakers, it was talked about, you know, they're desperate for shooting. Seth Curry's name was brought up, J.J. Redick, Danny Green, Kyle Korver. So the Lakers getting, you know, Danny Green after the dust settled and Kawhi decided to sign a long-term deal with the Clippers, he's a good pickup. And like you just mentioned, you mentioned AD and you mentioned LeBron James. There's going to be so much attention on those two players that's how Danny Green's going to be able to, you know, kind of succeed for the Lakers. Plus, he's a good defender, so that's what the Lakers are going to need from him. But he was a good addition. He's a player, too, for 2 years, even if the Lakers, you know, want max salary cap space for next season. The fact that 2 years after this year would be an expiring contract, they'll have some flexibility with some of these contracts. I think Danny Green is one of those contracts as well.
So what, as you look at the season, and I hashtagged your appearance on the program, and I've been having some fun with this, and, you know, I mean, we have now arrived at Battle for Los Angeles. And I'm really happy to see it because you and I both remember, and Tony Diodato, who was on before you, we remember the travesty that was the Clippers franchise playing in the sports arena, one bad thing after another. Donald Sterling was an absolute nightmare. They were the joke of the league. They go to the Staples Center with the Lakers, and, you know, this is the point I made a few minutes ago, Alan. You've got all the jerseys and the titles and the majestic colors. And then you have the nice little red and blue, you know, the little Clippers and the cute little logo, and they redid their logo, and it looks worse. And now suddenly they're a player. They're a big-time player, and, for lack of a better word, Staples Center has become the epicenter for what will be the 2019-2020 NBA season. It's going to be unbelievable. What do you see as your biggest concern for the Lakers, who have certainly improved themselves across the board? What is your biggest concern about this coming year?
Well, listen, you know, you were just, I think you referenced it perfect. L.A. is going to be the place for basketball across the country. You're going to have four of the top 10 players in the NBA playing almost every single night at Staples Center. And that's whether the Clippers got a home game or the Lakers have a home game. The Lakers' challenge is going to be this. There are a lot of good teams in the Western Conference, and it's very evenly matched. And I think it's good for the NBA to have that type of parity, but the Clippers can come out of the West. The Lakers can come out of the West. The Denver Nuggets, the Portland Trailblazers, the Houston Rockets, the Golden State Warriors, if they can get Klay at the right time. I mean, there's a lot of parity right now in the Western Conference. And I think for the Lakers, they're so dependent on two players, Anthony Davis and LeBron James. The concern is, if those guys put in too much mileage before playoffs start, or if injuries, like any team, it can happen. And you look at LeBron coming into be 35 years old in December. The Lakers have had a lot of health issues over the last couple of years. And what's very ironic, it happened to a lot of their young players. It was Lonzo Balls that were out, the Brandon Ingrams, you know, some of these guys. So for the Lakers, I think it's a matter of getting enough time to gel and hopefully not having to depend so much on their two stars to, obviously to get them into the postseason.
Who do you see what do you see? I'm going to give you a two-part question here. Number one, what do you see as the Lakers' rotation? And obviously, we can speculate and the camp's going to open, but you know that they've got some ideas of who it's going to be. And the second would be from one of our listeners, Seawalk, asking, is somebody like Andre Iguodala still in the mix?
So I think from how the Lakers will, you know, starting games is always tough to predict because it doesn't necessarily mean you start with your five best players. I think what's most important is how you're going to end the games. I think to end the games, LeBron, Anthony Davis, good chance Kyle Kuzma's in the lineup, good chance Danny Green's in the lineup, and probably a guy like Rajon Rondo just because of his experience. You know, he's been there for so long and understands how to get people in the right spot. So that's how probably Lakers end games. In regards to Andre Iguodala, you know, Christopher, that question mark about Andre Iguodala is so key for a lot of teams right now. I know if the Rockets thought they got him, then they'll feel much more confident about their chances of getting to the finals. If a team in the Eastern Conference that's competing, if the Lakers got Andre Iguodala, Iguodala is a key piece. But here's what it comes down to. The Memphis Grizzlies in that trade, they have Andre Iguodala, and there doesn't look to be a buyout. They want, if somebody wants him, they're going to have to trade for him. Lakers just don't have the assets to go out and make another trade. So he could very well end up on a different team that is a contender to win a championship.
Tell us here, we watch on TV, and I mean, I've been to the Staples Center, certainly. I've not been there for a Clippers game. They've got their fan base. It'll never be as big, maybe never is a strong word, but it's unlikely that it'll ever be as big as the Lakers. I equate it to when the New Jersey Devils came from Colorado, and they have their fans, and they sell out their games. But anybody thinking that they'll ever rule the New York metropolitan area like the New York Rangers do, they're kidding themselves. They're delusional. But that said, what is the environment like? What have you been picking up on down there relative to this new rivalry? Finally, this is going to be a rivalry. I think the Lakers probably, they won't necessarily come out and say it too much. That's my guess. But they've got to be happy, too, because it's kind of like SC and UCLA. Both schools, in terms of athletically, kind of detest each other. I mean, I went to SC, and I understand that. But both schools have always understood they're better because of the other school 11 miles away. Is it a little bit like that with the Lakers and the Clippers?
Well, I mean, look, the Lakers are going to have to go through the Clippers. The Clippers are going to have to go through the Lakers. These teams are going to be in each other's way in the Western Conference and in the same division. So, I did a show yesterday, and I kept mentioning this is a rivalry. You know, maybe in the past it hasn't been. There hasn't been that many storylines, and the two franchises never really collided. But, it's definitely colliding right now. It's Jeannie Buss versus Steve Ballmer. It's Jerry West, the logo, and obviously the success that he had with the Lakers now helping turn around the Clippers. It's Paul George and Kawhi Leonard, two Southern California natives that at one point wanted to be Lakers, find themselves on the Clippers. Paul George turned the Lakers down twice, once in free agency, and this time, obviously going over to, as part of this trade, requesting a trade to the Clippers. So there's a lot of storylines. I think you definitely have a rivalry coming, and I think, look, not just for LA, but just for the NBA in general, this is going to be a fascinating storyline. Unless you were a Laker fan, only if you were a Laker fan did you want to see Kawhi Leonard come to the Lakers. If you weren't a Laker fan, you 100% wanted to see him on another team, so there was parity in the league. And for him to fall in the Clippers' laps and to have Paul George there as well, it's going to be a fun season. And I think if we're lucky enough, maybe we'll get an opportunity to watch these two teams take on each other in the playoffs.
Last year, Golden State, it took 57 wins to win the Western Conference to get your team into the playoffs. It took 48. That's what the Clippers and the Spurs both got. What do you think it's going to be to win the Western Conference this year, and what do you think it's going to be for getting into the playoffs? Is it going to be 45? Is it going to be 48? And are we too quick to dismiss the Golden State Warriors because of KD leaving and Klay Thompson's injury?
So I think it's going to take probably in that high 50 mark will be who leads the Western Conference. The problem is there's so many good teams that I think they are going to beat up on each other, so I don't think you're going to get this amazing record in the Western Conference. So right around there. And I think to get in, you're probably in that 47 to 49 range to get into the playoffs again. And again, there's going to be a lot of teams. We haven't talked about the Dallas Mavericks who got better. The Sacramento Kings got better. I mean, there's a good amount of teams in the West that are going to be competing. In regards to the Golden State Warriors, oh, no question about it. They'll be in the mix. And I think anybody that tries to pretend that they're just out of the way, what they're not is they're not a guarantee to win a championship like they've been for the last 3-4 years. But even before Klay Thompson comes back, I think they'll be in the thick of things, and they'll be obviously well coached and still good enough talent with now D'Angelo Russell joining that team. And once Klay comes back, they can win a championship, in my opinion, like any of these other teams in the Western Conference, as long as they're healthy.
Well, I think that's very well said, because talking to some media pals and some buddies around the country, there has almost been, Alan, this dismissive attitude about the Warriors. And I think that some are forgetting that Steph is still there. Draymond Green is still there. They just got, they just picked up D'Angelo. They've got Clay coming back at some point. This is not a team that, with KD leaving, this is not a team that suddenly is going from 57 wins to 35 wins.
Well, I think, look, this is probably the best example that I could give. When Clay Thompson went out in game six, almost you could say early on in the third quarter or close to the midway point of the third quarter, they're playing the Toronto Raptors, a championship team that's 100% healthy. And if it wasn't for Steph Curry missing a shot at almost the buzzer, they could have forced the game seven in Toronto without Klay Thompson and without Kevin Durant. So, a lot of things, obviously have to go their way. They have to make sure they're healthy and everything else. But I don't. When people say, well, the Warriors are not making the playoffs next year, I kind of smirk. I'm like, yeah, I don't know if people know just how well that organization has been run and how well it's been coached and how much these players have sacrificed. So I'm not on that boat. Let's put it that way.
Lastly, I want to get you out of the Los Angeles area for a second. I'm going to tell you, I don't know what's going to happen with Russell Westbrook. And I have said, and I don't care what anybody says, I've heard NBA players trying to downplay the fact that, the people leaving OKC, it's not any kind of slight against Russell Westbrook. That may be true, but I don't buy that completely. I just don't buy that completely when you see the guys who have left there. That aside, how do you see him as a possible teammate with Jimmy Butler? Because I'm going to tell you, I don't see that working out that well.
I think if Miami was found a way to get that kind of talent to come in and play for that organization, to have an offseason where you can acquire Jimmy Butler and Russell Westbrook, I think there will be, with Coach Eric Spoelstra, with Pat Riley, I think they'll find a way to use that talent and use Russell Westbrook to their full advantage. And in my opinion, if they can make it happen in the Eastern Conference, I'm all good for Russell Westbrook to get on a team that's competing. And as much loyalty that he's shown to the Oklahoma City Thunder, and I know there's people out there that say, well, that's why KD left or that's why Paul George just left. I'm a Russell Westbrook fan, and I'm not saying that the guy is a blueprint of how basketball players should play. I think he's got his issues. But I also think that at this stage of his career, if he can go to another organization, he can have some help, be the second best player on that team. I'd be curious to see what he can put together. But me personally, I'm rooting for the guy. I do want to see him succeed, whether that's in Miami or somewhere else. I don't want to see him in Houston because the Lakers already have enough teams that they're going to be battling with. I'd like to see him succeed somewhere, hopefully in the Eastern Conference.
Well, let me be real clear, because this audience knows how I feel about Russell Westbrook. It's a dichotomy. I like him as a player. I've said many times I like him as a player. I'm simply saying I just don't see, Alan, I don't see the personality mix between him with him and Jimmy Butler on the same team. I'm with you. He's an explosive player. He's fun to watch play. He's the kind of guy that you really want. He reminds me of an enforcer in hockey. He's the guy that you really don't like on the other guys, but, boy, when he gets traded to your team, you are elated. I'd like to see him have some success beyond what he's already had. I just I have my questions about whether or not that personality mix works in Miami. But certainly if he were to land there, that would put Miami a little bit more on the map. Folks, you need to check out our good friend Alan Sliwa. He is the host of Lakers Talk Mondays, 7 to 9 p.m. on ESPN Los Angeles. Glad you are safe, my friend, even though you were out of town. Glad you're safe. And we will certainly be talking sooner than later, I am quite sure.
Sounds good, Christopher. Thank you, man. Appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. He is Alan Sliwa. Coming up next, we're going to switch from basketball to soccer, and we're going to get a wrap-up on the Women's World Cup with our elite soccer mind, Joel Listman. This is the CGP.
More of the Christopher Gabriel Program right now on 940 ESPN.
Final half hour, working our way to the top of the hour. Home Run Derby live from Cleveland right here on 940 ESPN. I could swear that I saw Joel Listman in the crowd in Lyon in a red, white, and blue, a very festive-looking outfit with an eagle head hat. It may have been him. It may not have been him. Regardless, wherever he comes to us from today, he is here, Joel Listman. How are you, my friend?
I'm good. I cannot confirm nor can I deny that that was me.
All right.
Me and my eagle head have been known to show up in various parts of the world doing various things.
I've heard that, and your lovely wife has told me that before. So we'll just leave it there. And
that's
and,
true. Yeah, and there's some things that are not for public consumption.
No question. I have to tell you, this was a great final on Sunday. My favorite player on this U.S. team is Rose Lavelle. I just love watching her play soccer. Why do we love watching her? And I'm glad that Megan Rapinoe really came out and said she's not a superstar in the making. She's there.
Yeah, I think we love watching her play because she's exciting. She does her. She's gritty. She's like, she's a Charlie Hustle. She just is constantly moving. And she is creative. She is the goal that she scored, was absolutely the perfect way to usher in the new era of U.S. women's soccer. Now, with this victory with the World Cup ending, we're going to be saying goodbye to a lot of amazing players, and this will become Rose Lavelle's team. She is the next superstar. We're going to be talking about Rose Lavelle the way we talk about Megan Rapinoe, the way we talk about Alex Morgan, the way we talked about Abby Wambach and Mia Hamm. The next up is Rose Lavelle, and she's great, and she's a Midwesterner, so I have a fondness for that.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I mean, she went to Wisconsin, I have a nephew that goes to Wisconsin, and that's a school that I almost went to, but yeah, she's a Midwest kid, and I think she's from Ohio originally. If I'm not mistaken, but she's fun to watch. This team has been fun to watch. I don't even know where to begin. It seems like this game would have been about 7 or 8-0 if it wasn't for the Dutch goalkeeper. She was terrific.
Yeah, she had a tremendous game, and she's had a great tournament, which is weird considering she was just released by her club team.
Yeah.
So she had a great tournament and currently has no club to go back to play with. But yeah, and it absolutely was. This was, it was a game plan set out by the Dutch that they thought they could beat the U.S. on a counterattack, that they knew the U.S. was going to come with pressure, and that they thought they could rely on their defense and on their goalkeeper and have an outlet and try to beat the U.S. on a break. Good plan, exceptionally tough to execute that plan. And you saw in the first half the Dutch get a few opportunities on the break. The Netherlands actually did a terrific job in the first half of neutralizing the U.S. midfield, taking Rose Lavelle out of the game, taking Mewis out of the game. U.S. Pretty much had to go directly from the defensive line and chip that ball over, and they created opportunities, but that's not how the U.S. likes to play. They would prefer to play through the midfield and get their creative players going. And then the adjustments that the team made in the second half allowed that U.S. team, allowed them to play a little bit more through the midfield by spreading their spreading the players out wide, getting their wingers further out on the sides of the pitch, and create some more space in the middle that allowed them to work it. And then the penalty, the chip in, the high boot on Alex Morgan, And then once the Netherlands went behind, then you knew that the game was going to open up, and that the U.S. was going to get more and more chances because the Netherlands had to push forward and try to get a goal.
Elite soccer mind Jill Lissman joining me. Jill Ellis, is she the greatest national team coach that the United States has ever produced? Is that overstating it?
Ooh, wow. Is she the greatest? That's tough. I mean, the stats are there. To do it, it's not like you're knock on Phil Jackson, but it's not like you're Phil Jackson and you have all these rings and you played with Michael Jordan on your team. She has done it with several different groups of players, has won back to back. And, you can make an argument, but, Jill Ellis stands on the shoulders of Pia Sundhagen and the coaches before her. You could argue that, I'm not sure I'm prepared to call her the greatest, could certainly say that she's up there.
Let me take an off ramp and say, what is it about her coaching? And let's limit it to this particular team, because you watched this national team play, this women's national team play, and the word that comes to mind and has come to mind from the first time I saw them was relentless. They are just relentless, not only offensively, but in the way they go after teams defensively. Is that is that vintage Jill Ellis right there?
That's the way that she understood this. She understood the players that she had and the players that she liked to play. And frankly, the way... The kind of players that the U.S. is producing right now, tough, fast, aggressive players, and still having natural scorers, you can play this brand. You can play a type of soccer that's going to be high pressing and very, very attack minded because the team is good enough to withstand any sort of counterattack. You have good enough defenders with Becky Sauerbrunn, with Julie Ertz. You have these players that can withstand a counterattack and can handle a quick wave if that team can break through them. When Jill Ellis was starting to build this team, there were question marks surrounding this team after 2015, after the last World Cup, and who was going to, who Jill Ellis was going to bring in with the departures of a lot of the members of the 2015 team, and with Carly Lloyd and stuff getting a little older and stuff. So there were games where the U.S. team looked really out of sorts. She tried different styles of play. She tried players in different positions, and ultimately, she looked at who she could bring in and looked at the kind of player that was out there and said, this is how we can maximize the talent of these players. And by putting these players out there, it created a new role for for a player like Carly Lloyd, who, scored a hat trick in the 2015 final. So Carly Lloyd was relegated to a bench player because you needed someone who could come in off the bench and kill off a game when your team's ahead and pester and have that kind of control. But Carly Lloyd is a much more possession oriented player and also doesn't quite have the speed that some of that Tobin Heath, Alex Morgan Rose Lavelle have. So she, so it meant that you're putting one of the best players and saying, hey, you're great, but you need to serve a different role with this team.
You mentioned, quick thought on Rose Lavelle, that goal that she scored, I equated it to when she did that little crossover move at the end to give herself some space. It reminded, who reminded me of? Allen Iverson.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, what was beautiful about it is, you know, on the stage, in the moment, you know, biggest game of her career, biggest game of any of these players' careers. And she's striding forward, and she's seeing the defender backing off of her. And so she knows exactly what to do, a little, you know, a little drop of the shoulder, and she can move the defender exactly where she wants her. She can move the, she knows, she moves the goaltender exactly, you know, just one more step to Rose Lavelle's left. She knows exactly, she was by her shoulder movements, by her body positioning, she was moving the Dutch players where she wanted them to go so she could hit that shot into the bottom right corner. And it was really, really a terrific goal. It may just look like she was coasting in and the players were backing off and she hit the shot and scored a goal, but she was shifting those players around just with little movements of her body, and it really was a terrific goal.
Well, you really explained that beautifully, because I think that's some of that what you just said was completely lost on me, and now I'm remembering that goal. And yeah, exactly what you said with her movements and how she created the space by the way she attacked. I want to take this a step further. We're visiting with Joel Listman. The Golden State Warriors, no mystery, the last 5 years, they have changed the way the NBA plays. And other teams try to play like them, but other teams have not had Steph Curry and Klay Thompson. And that's the difference. Has this U.S. Women's National Team, this particular team, have they changed? I don't mean they've changed the entire sport, but have they shifted the way other countries are going to look to make up their teams? Because the United States is obviously the bar, and much like the Warriors have been the bar, and teams have had to essentially recruit or draft or trade to try and meet that bar and exceed it. Is that what the U.S. Women's National Team has done for the sport of soccer?
Yes. U.S. soccer, especially on the women's side, are, you know, they're able to pull from a much deeper pool of players. The success of the women's national team, it's the reason why it is so successful dates all the way back to Title IX. The fact that, we as a country, it has not been perfect and it has been a struggle, but the fact that Title IX exists and there has been a government that has said we are prioritizing women's athletics to a certain extent, that is what's created this dominance in this sport for our country. Other countries will have a hard time until their sports federations really put forth and prioritize women's athletics and women's soccer. They have a limited pool of players to pull from. Now, Germany, Sweden, France, and we're starting to see these countries. The Netherlands, this was only their second World Cup ever. They have made it up, they have prioritized women's soccer, and so now the number of players to choose from and the level that they're playing at, it continues to increase. I think you're going to see teams adopting a more aggressive style, a more aggressive type of play, and utilizing the physical attributes that some of these women have to play a much more physical game, and it's going to make the game it has the potential to make the game a lot more exciting. It also has the potential to make the game a lot more it might slow the game down because the physicalness will create a lot more fouls. It's just all part of the evolution of the game as players become more skilled and are able to do more. Teams will have to foul in order to slow teams down.
My guest is Joel Listman, and it seems, especially on the women's side, you know, the program that immediately comes to mind is North Carolina. They've won. We talk about UCLA in men's basketball, or Connecticut, and during Connecticut, Tennessee in women's basketball. But you look at North Carolina soccer, women's soccer. I just looked up the number, 21 national championships at one point, 9 in a row, 12 in 13 years, 14 in 16 years. Is this part of the reason why women's soccer, the women's national team, has been so good? Because essentially the feeder organization has been college soccer, and those programs are so good, and young girls playing soccer understand that there's a lot of places whether it's UConn, whether it's North Carolina, Notre Dame, UCLA, New Mexico, there's a lot of great soccer programs to go to.
It absolutely is. Soccer is a relatively inexpensive it can get expensive like any sport, but it is a relatively inexpensive sport to finance, which is why when Title IX started, that's why a lot of schools adopted soccer programs, because they didn't have to make as huge an upfront investment in equipment as some of the other sports might have. So these programs have sprouted up, and you had lots of former players and on the men's side, a lot of former players on the men's side and coming through and saying, well, hey, yeah, I'll coach. Sure. I don't mind. It's a job. It's a job opportunity, and found, hey, I have eager and willing athletes that are willing to put in the time and effort because they now have an opportunity to go to a great educational institution and so suddenly you have these, you have these great schools creating these great programs, and greatness begets greatness, as you well know. And with no professional program, with no professional, it's like the early days of, before the MLS even came about, you'd have these teams or these college teams, and then once they graduate, they really don't have an outlet anymore other than the national team. So obviously women's clubs, the club teams are increasing around the world, and hopefully that will continue in this country as well. We have a saturated sports market, and it's tough to break through now, even as a niche sport, when you're having to compete with things like ESPN covering pickleball or whatever. So.
Well, if you don't knock things like bog snorkeling. That's huge.
And the intensity that goes into a game of bags, that's bristling entertainment.
It is bristling. We've got a couple of minutes left, so I want to squeeze a couple of things in these couple of minutes. VAR, good for the sport or not so good?
Sorry, say that one more time.
VAR. VAR.
Oh, VAR.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it doesn't matter if it's good or bad for the sport. It's here. It's here to stay. I know that's a real milquetoast answer, but it's here. It's going to get better. They're going to get better at using it. It will make referees. I think it will free up referees to keep the flow of the game hopefully going, knowing that if there is a mistake, there is a chance that it might be corrected. VAR is a big deal, but ultimately, if it means that correct decisions are made, I guess ultimately that means that it's going to be good for the sport.
And I've assiduously avoided the whole equal pay situation because I'm really tired of talking about it. Tired of it because it shouldn't be an issue. It should be equal pay, men and women, and everybody has theories. There's actual numbers out there, but everybody has theories. Is this something that the United States Soccer Federation is going to address?
Well, yes. I hope so. Obviously, I hope so. The U.S. Here's my take on it. There's lots of memes and facts and figures and articles being written. How much? What is the real numbers? Ultimately, ultimately, FIFA has to, you know, has to get on board with all of this. And there needs to be someone to be a leader. And I am, you know, as someone who is a big fan of the country that we live in, for all its, for all the good things and for all its faults, there is no reason why the United States should not be the leader. And the U.S. Soccer Federation should just say, you know what, new policy, you know, let's have a policy of equality across the board. We'll figure it out. And we're going to figure out how to not only make this be a model of consistency for our women's program, but we're going to find a way that it also makes our men's program better. And that will be the, and that will be something for FIFA and the rest of the world to point to and say, sure, yes, the men's team is not one of the premier teams in the world, but they are running things the way things should be run, and we will follow suit because hopefully if U.S. soccer can find a way to make it work and the U.S. men's team can get back, you know, we're still a ways away from winning the World Cup, and winning a men's World Cup is an incredibly difficult prospect. But if the U.S. team can start finding success, if the U.S. men's team can start finding success again, then they can do it while having a model of equality, then that is going to be nothing but good things for the rest of the world to point and say, that is how we should be.
And that's a well-said answer. We'll leave it right there because we are out of time. He is Joel Lisman. Joel, I can't thank you enough for all the great conversation we've had over the last couple of months.
Thank you so much, my friend.
Absolutely. One more thing is next. This is the CGP. My thanks to Tony D, Alan Sliwa, and Joel Lisman. My guy Russ doing his usual great job, and to all of you. Home Run Derby coming up next live from Cleveland, Ohio. And then tomorrow it's the All-Star Game. We'll do 1 hour and then get you off to Cleveland. So we'll see you in about 22 hours. Until then, you're on your own.